At this point, I have put up on the webpage those recordings of classes that I remember to record. I've just turned on the recorder, so this one will get recorded. So if you want to review classes with luck, they'll be there. I thought what I would do today is to say a little bit about the two papers that you read for today, which are old class papers, then go on to continue the discussion of cases that you've read from the main book for this bit of the course, cases that struck you as interesting and some that struck me as interesting, then discuss some sort of general issues about the legal system that we've now been observing, and finally talk a bit about the Tibetan legal system, which one of the papers was on. The two papers illustrate two of the kinds of papers that are appropriate for this course. The Chinese paper is taking a subject we've looked at, but then trying to go into it at a considerably greater depth, and in particular to use sources we haven't seen. And that one, I would say, is not entirely satisfactory. Noticeable amount of it is stuff that's already in the book, but it also looks at other sources, of which, to me at least, the most interesting one is the book which I think of as Golden Lotus, since that's the title I first saw it under the translation. I think she uses a slightly different title, but it is a very famous Chinese novel, which I think I encountered, I don't know where I first encountered it. And it's famous for two different reasons. One is it's great literature, and the other is because it's substantially pornographic. So that the translation I first saw, what I found sort of amusing, was mostly in English and part of it was in Latin. They had translated the pornographic bits into Latin, presumably on the assumption that scholars who knew Latin were not vulnerable to being distracted by such things, which I thought was amusing. But I'm sure there's a modern translation which is all in English somewhere. But I did think I would tell you the story of how this novel came to be written. I should say I doubt this is a historically accurate story, but it's what I understand to be the traditional story. Because, of course, one of the puzzles from the standpoint of the Chinese is how you would have great literature, which was also pornographic. And the explanation, it seems, is that there was an evil and corrupt official and a good and noble official. And the evil and corrupt official somehow, by intrigue, manages to destroy the good and noble official. How, I don't remember. Each of them has a son. And the son of the evil corrupt official is a still more evil and corrupt official, but the son of the good and noble and honest official is a still more good, noble, honest, and talented official, and decides to get revenge. And the way he gets revenge is by writing Golden Lotus, which, being a great literary scholar, as all good officials are supposed to be, he was able to do. And he made it very readable, and he also made it rather pornographic for reasons that will become clear in a moment. And when he had written it, he embedded in the corner of each page a grain of poison. And he then sent it as a gift to the evil and corrupt official. And because it was great literature and pornographic, the evil and corrupt official read right through it, turning the pages, licking his thumb to get the page to turn it, and on the last page dropped dead. So that's the story of how Golden Lotus came to be written, at least the traditional Chinese story. And I think it's a good enough story to share with you, even though I do not vouch for its historical accuracy.
Isn't it just been corrupt and pornographic and still got the same effect?
That's an interesting question. I don't know whether... I think it's also supposed to be, to some extent, a portrayal of the misdeeds of the one or both of the two evil officials. But I guess the assumption is that even evil officials have to be properly educated in Confucian literature and therefore will appreciate learned. And I don't know. You'd have to ask a Confucian scholar, which I am not. But anyway, so one of the possible papers to do, and in some ways the harder one, because in a sense you've got to go further than we've already gone in our sources, would be if for one of the legal systems we're looking at, you can find additional sources that really cast additional and interesting light on the subject and then write them up. That on a lot of the time we're looking, as here, we're looking mainly at the sort of official view of the system. And probably by this point in your legal career, you have already concluded that there is a sizable difference between the American legal system as sort of popularly portrayed in high school classes or something, and the American legal system you're actually going to work in. For example, I gather that most criminal cases never get resolved by trial. They're settled by plea bargaining, which in a sense is simple model of how people think of our legal system as working. You don't really get a trial by jury at all. You get a bargain over your sentence. So it's sort of neat if you have something like Golden Lotus, where you've got a fictional account, but a fictional account written by contemporaries, or people inside that system, describing how they think it really works in practice, where the murderer gets off by appropriately giving gifts, so they giving bribes essentially to the officials, and the officials then find some excuse to dismiss the case and possibly to punish the person who complains, which is another point that comes up in the real cases as well. So I don't know if you can do that for any of the other ones we're looking at. You may not want to try, but it's at least worth mentioning. The Tibetan case is, I think, quite a satisfactory paper from my standpoint of what I think of as the more common kind of paper for this course, where somebody finds some legal system we haven't studied, finds at least, in this case, one good source for it, and some, I guess, some additional material, and then does roughly what we're doing. Or you can see, if you imagine, if I had wanted to, I could have taken that Tibetan paper and made that a week of this class, basically, since it's doing the same thing these sources are doing, and doing, I thought, a pretty good job of it. So that's what I suspect most of you should do. Most of you, by the way, ought to have figured out what your paper is by now. If you haven't, you may be running a little bit late, or at least have a first guess so you can go looking for sources, because you're in real trouble if you have this great idea and then start working on it a week before it's due and discover at that point there are no sources on the legal system you want to cover. So you'd better find out whether the sources are there by about now. But in any case, that's another kind of paper, and it's sort of, in some ways, I don't know, it's more or less interesting, but both of them. Yeah?
I mean, I've read these articles quickly, but both of them to me seem like a synopsis of, like, this type of legal system. It didn't seem really heavy in, like, making analysis of our own legal system and what could be the possible differences.
That's all right. That is, I would say that if you... In a sense, from the standpoint of this course, our legal system is no more special than any others, right? I mean, you can compare anything to anything, but the basic idea of something like the Tibetan paper is not to compare it to our legal system, it's to find how it works. So that, from my standpoint, she could have written the same paper if she was taking this course in Japan or in 18th century England or in saga period Iceland, assuming they had the sources and such, that the real question is not how does it compare to our system, which is, you know, nothing special about it except you happen to know it well. Nothing wrong with pointing out comparisons if they turn out to be interesting. But the basic idea is to take these things seriously in their own terms, to say this is a way in which a whole bunch of human beings at some time and some place organize their legal system. I want to understand it.
You're more looking for that than the comparison.
That's right. That pure comparisons wouldn't be very interesting, and you can't really do them because you've got to... You can't do just the comparison, you have to understand the system to compare it. So the main thing is to take some legal system, some time, some place, and understand it. Think of it, imagine that on your first week in law school, that some kind person had said, look, you're going to be learning huge amounts of stuff, let's orient you. Here is a 20-page summary of the American legal system with one paragraph on intellectual property and, you know, maybe a page on torts and half a page on procedure, but some attempt so that you would go into your law school experience with a vague map of the territory you were going to be exploring. Sort of think of doing that for somebody else.
Okay.
All right?
And so then not focusing specifically on one... Because I noticed the paragraph on marriage.
Yes. Yes.
Could be a whole paper in itself. I mean,
yep.
You can really get into all that.
Yeah, but I think an upper bound of 100 pages is the... No, I'm assuming this kind of length. It's sort of... I mean, pages aren't really very useful given we all have word processors and can adjust fonts and stuff. But obviously, any legal system... Well, any well-documented legal system could easily be a book. I mean, the Chinese one, this is a book, and it doesn't cover anything like all you could say. If people want to do more on Chinese, by the way, I have two other sources, books that I've acquired, which I'd be happy to lend somebody who wants to go through them. One of them has to do with China under the Mongols, and I haven't read that one, I just got it. The other is a collection of cases that were translated by Van Gulik, the person who I mentioned wrote the detective stories set in China. They're, I think, a pretty interesting picture of that society. But this one is actually a collection of cases that was used in China for a long time as sort of a part of how you study how they studied the legal system, as it were. And it's not very much like this because many of them are cases about how a clever magistrate figured out what happened. So that many of them are sort of like very short capsule detective stories. I seem to remember there's some case where it matters whether a pig was burned to death in the barn burning down or was killed earlier. And the detective says, aha, look in its mouth and see if there are ashes in the mouth. Because if it was already dead when the building burned down, its mouth was closed, it wasn't breathing, there would be no ashes in it. I just happen to remember that as one incident. So, but it also has ones where the judge is saying, what's the right verdict for something? So in that sense, it's partly parallel to this, though not very closely. It's much earlier. That is, these are cases from, I don't remember, maybe 1,000 to 1,500, something like that. So all before these cases. I'm sure are other sources I don't know about. I mean, there are other Chinese novels that have been translated. I just happen to know about Golden Lotus. So it would be possible to do another paper on China, provided you, by some combination of the sources that I could offer you and other sources you could find, could get enough material. But as I say, I expect what most people will do is to find some other legal system that they can make sense of.
You want the overview of the whole legal system and not a paper focused on a specific area?
Well, that depends. If if your information is on a specific area and there's enough there to make a paper, that's fine. You can't write the whole book. I mean, you can, but I don't expect you to do it for this course. Maybe next year, or next decade or something. But you're going to have some overview because you can't really make sense of part of a legal system. You try to imagine describing American intellectual property law to somebody from Imperial China from 300 years ago. It would not make very much sense. All right, the categories wouldn't. Is the reason that you punish somebody for a copyright because this is offensive to the spirit, to the natural order to violate things? Is it that the emperor has forbidden you from doing it? None of those reasons? Well, why do you have a punishment for that? So you have to have some framework, I think. But whether you sort of evenly try to give a summary of the whole system, or whether you give a brief summary of the system and then say the really interesting thing about this is how they handled criminal law, and I'm going to go on for 15 pages on that, that's up to you. I mean, I guess the main thing is I want to end up knowing a good deal more about some legal system than I did before I read the article. You ought to take at least a quick look at the papers that are already webbed, because there's no point in duplicating one that's already been done. And beyond that, if something you want to do has been done but not webbed, I may discourage you, depending on whether it looks as though there's enough more material to do something else on that. All right. Other questions? All right, let's go back to the cases. I've got notes on lots of them, but I'm curious about other ones that you read where you thought there was something interesting or puzzling or worth discussing. Anybody? Cases that you've been reading? Right.
But then he was caught for another theft later that he
right.
actually did commit.
Yes.
They reduced the sentence of having the other wrist tattooed because he had the mistaken tattoo on the previous wrist.
But they didn't remove the tattoo.
That was the mistake that was somehow rectified by
yes.
not giving him the new one.
Yes.
So it was like another instance of that sort of cosmic.
And the comment, well, that's an interesting question, huh? I guess that couldn't happen. I mean, it seems perfectly, aside from cosmic harmony, it seems in a sense just if you, I don't know of any procedure in our system. Suppose you're arrested for a crime, spend 5 years in jail, and at that point they discover the guy who really didn't let you out. And the next week you actually commit a crime and are convicted. I don't think you get to say, now subtract 5 years from my sentence because I've already served them. And yet, in a way, it seems as though you should be able to, but maybe not. Anyway, But yes, so I don't know if it's cosmic harmony or justice, but the comment I think made by the editors is that you might argue that the original miscarriage of justice was the reason for his second theft, that once he had been tattooed he couldn't get honest employment, basically, because he was believed falsely to be a thief, and so, you know. Yeah, but at least that was not the case. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I think one ought to get reading these cases is just the feel for the fact that this is, in some senses, a very alien culture. That it isn't that they're more merciful or less merciful so much as they have a very different set of ways of thinking of these problems. So that you get, you know, quite routinely these cases where they explain why the behavior was perfectly excusable, so we're only going to give him 3 years forced labor. And it will be nice to do that instead of giving him strangulation after the assizes or something. But at the same time, they care about their system because you've got these repeated cases where they go into some detail to discover, to figure out the right sentence, either on somebody who's already dead, or in another case where they say, you were wrong to sentence him to this punishment under this statute. You should have sentenced him to the identical punishment, but under that statute. And there are one or two cases, at least, where that's happening. So in that case, again, you have the feeling that the officials really do care about sort of getting it right in some odd sense. I also have a little bit of a feeling that one of the features of human beings is that we have very good pattern recognition software built in, which is why when they try to make computers that can actually see, it turns out to be very, very hard. If you try to think about a computer which could take in what your eyes are taking in and make sense of it. Not just there's a bit of tan color over there, but there's a table sitting there, a person sitting there, a laptop sitting there. That's a really hard problem, it turns out. One consequence is that human beings have such good pattern recognition software that we can find patterns that aren't there. And we do. If you think of a standard conspiracy theory, it would be an example of that. And I have a feeling that part of what's going on in these cases is that the people who are, in effect, writing the cases really believe there's a complete internal coherent logic to their legal system. And that therefore, when they're trying to say, well, this doesn't fit the statute, where does it go? It isn't, where do I want it to go? It's more like a scientist saying, well, this is a somewhat hard problem, but if you're logical enough about it, aha, it fits right into that niche. And then again, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Do you think that's more a reference for their legal system, or is it more about?
I don't know. It isn't sort of a strict stare decisis system, as far as you can tell. They occasionally refer to other cases, but I don't think they've got a compilation of all previous cases that anyone's actually studying. So no, it could be. I mean, you could imagine so many cases where they say, "Well, all right, it's going to come up again. Let's settle it now." But I don't know if that's what's going on in that case or not. Could be. Yeah.
One thing that's actually stuck with the first two papers were conveyed
is
that idea of thinking the system is complete, pervasive legalist thinking, that the law should be written and well-known and cover as many possible things as possible, so that any interaction that human beings could have with one another in society would really be an interaction with the state.
But what that's in tension with is that it does not sound as though they really expect the ordinary people to know in much detail what the law is. That the population can't read. Being a lawyer is in effect illegal. So at the same time, they're trying to have a system of statutes that solves all questions. And yet I think, though I may be wrong, they are assuming that what's supposed to control the populace is not the knowledge that this act is illegal, but the knowledge is wicked. That is, maybe I'm wrong, but at least as I read it, they don't assume that when you are trying to decide whether or not to kill your son-in-law for observing your adulterous affair, that you actually know whether the result of that is strangulation after the assizes, immediate strangulation, or merely life exile to 4,000 li away. I think that the detailed rules are for the court so that it knows the answer, because you've got these bunch of cases where they have essentially open ways in which you can convict somebody something that's nowhere in the statutes, that violating the imperial decree, doing what ought not to be done. All of those seem to imply that the people are supposed to know what's right and wrong, and that therefore these are just ways of patching the system so that we know what to do with somebody by fitting him into one of these. And there are a number of things that are not quite as vague as doing what ought not to be done, but, you know, I don't know what it is, you know, being a villain who has repeatedly annoyed respectable people, that's not quite right, but there's one of the statutes that's something like that. And, you know, what does that mean? Well, it means somebody who we obviously want to punish, but it isn't clear exactly where he fits into the system. Yeah, that's right. Yes? Issues. One of them is anonymous accusations, and the other is accusations in general. I think that I think there are several things going on. I think the anonymous accusation bit is that they don't want to have an easy channel by which I can get someone I dislike at no risk to myself by telling the authorities that he's done something bad anonymously. And you can imagine that I could do that. How do you stop me from doing it? Well, the obvious... If I leave a paper, you know, a written statement somewhere for the authorities to see, you aren't going to know who did it. But you can say, but if the authorities aren't allowed to read such a statement, which is what the law seems to have been, if I write it down and leave it somewhere, somebody else who finds it isn't allowed to take it to the authorities. So I think the anonymous accusation, it makes sense because it looks to me at least as though it would be a very easy way of feuding with people, as it were, and a nuisance from the standpoint of the court system. But the other more interesting issue, where I think there's a real tension among different levels of the system, is non-anonymous accusations. And as you may have noticed, there are a number of cases where there's a late case, which is pointing out that all the earlier cases have been misapplying the statute. And this has to do with somebody who reports an offense. And this is, for example, the guy whose son or wife, I forget, was killed by incorrect acupuncture, if you remember, and some other treatment. There's this case where a doctor treats somebody for cholera who doesn't have cholera, at least that's the implication of the case. The patient dies. The father accuses him. The court finds that, yes, indeed, he did treat somebody for the wrong thing, and it did result in death, although it wasn't an intentional killing, and therefore the punishment is some quite serious punishment, which however gets commuted to a very small monetary payment. But the father who accused him receives, I think it may just be 100 blows of the bamboo, I don't remember if he gets any further sentence or not. Why? Because he embellished the truth in his accusation. And if I remember correctly, and I haven't reread the last few cases yet, this is citing a statute which explicitly involves somebody who goes to the emperor himself, stops the emperor in his carriage, and says, you know, there's been a terrible miscarriage of justice, Your Majesty, can you do something about it? And the statute says, well, if he does that, and it isn't entirely correct what he says, then he gets punished. And what seems to be happening is that the courts, and I suspect these are mostly the lower level courts, are leaving out the bit about the emperor, applying this statute to anybody who complains about a case. And you can see, therefore, that their incentive in doing this is that they don't want to be detected doing a bad job. I'm not sure that's what's happening, but a possible interpretation, I'm the district magistrate, and I settle a case in some way, and I think it's the right way, but someone is unhappy that the father of the dead boy or whatever is unhappy. He goes to my superiors and says, look, this district magistrate has acted unjustly. He hasn't given us justice. Do I want him to do that? No. So what would I like to do? I want an excuse to punish people who do things like that at the earliest stage. So that's a possible reading. And then there's a much later case where the higher-ups are saying, no, the statute only says when you interrupt the emperor, damn it, you can't apply it for these things. And they, I think, are interpreting it in my way, though I'm not sure if you could go look at that case. It wasn't one of the ones you read, so you can't easily find it, but it's one of the cases near the end where they discuss that. So anyway, I mean, you can see that... But part of it also, I think, is that the whole system, both in this and in the Tibetan one, really is aimed at keeping things out of the courts if they can, because they've got limited resources, and therefore making it risky to try to invoke the legal system makes some sense. Yeah.
I think it's interesting with China, with the laws being made structured to keep the peace for efficiency of the state. In America, we see people disputing their own disputes and not taking them to the courts as creating a kind of anarchy. But there, it's kind of the opposite. You know, it seems like if people can resolve their issues and not take them, you know, then we're being efficient and things are working out because our courts aren't.
But of course, our system also has an awful lot of authorized settlement outside of the court. A large fraction of commercial disputes are handled by arbitration. And the courts approve of that. They will normally enforce arbitrated awards and so forth. So, and you can also think about our whole plea bargaining system. In a sense, it's all done under the threat of the court, as it were. But the plea bargaining system, in a certain sense, is a way of drastically reducing the amount of work the court system has to do by making sure that most criminal cases never come to a final trial. I think that's a correct statement. I'm not sure.
Well, we have a lot of descriptions on how you can take long journey. What I've read, it doesn't seem like there is a lot of governance around that.
Yes, but as far as I can tell here, I'm not sure that they're ever approving of. See, the problem is, of course, that what counts as taking the law into your own hands partly depends on what people are legally allowed to do to things. Nobody thinks that whipping your horse to make it go faster is taking the law into your own hands. Well, from their standpoint, beating your slave isn't taking the law into your own hands either. Beating your wife is taking the law into your own hands only if you break a limb, if you break a bone. That anything short of that is within the legitimate authority of the father or the master to the slave or the parent to the child in various circumstances. So those things, they're pushing the control out of the court system, but not by allowing people to do otherwise illegal things. And my impression looking at this is that all of the cases that are really taking the law into your own hands in terms of their law, which are things like somebody breaks into your house and you not only stop him, you kill him. Or you pull off his clothes and throw him out in the cold and he dies of exposure. Those get punished pretty severely, right? So in that sense, I think it's more a matter of delegating a whole lot of authority in the sense of saying it is legal. Here are the other authority structures. It's legal people within them to do certain things to control those lower down. One of the things I noticed, by the way, if I understand correctly some of these cases, is that normally, any relationship is symmetrical. If you are my older kinsman, I'm your younger kinsman. It isn't the case, I think, for concubines and slaves. If I've got it correctly, the concubine owes obligations to the relatives of her master, which correspond to her being in a particular kinship relationship. She, from the standpoint of her obligations to other people, she's fitted into the kinship system in a certain niche. But I don't think it goes the other way around. I think if the other relatives injure the concubine, it's treated as between unrelated people. I think that's right. I'm not positive. So that was sort of an odd case where for certain purposes, sort of subordinates are treated as kin, and for certain purposes, they aren't. Other things that people is interesting discuss. Anonymous accusation is a capital offense. 80 blows heavy if you see somebody else's and bring it to the authorities, as you were saying, and 100 blows to the official who acts on it. And the accused party is not to be tried even if the accusation is true, which suggests the obvious strategy if you've committed a crime of putting in an anonymous accusation of yourself in the hopes that that way they won't try you for the crime. I don't know how well that one would work. Yeah?
Can
I don't know. I can tell you what the size of the bamboos were. I did check that in one of the sources. And a small bamboo was supposed to be an inch and a half at the large end and an inch at the small end, where those are Chinese inches, but they don't seem to be, I think, they're actually a little bigger, because what I've got here is an inch. The large end is 5.5 centimeters. So yeah, I guess their inches may be a little bigger than ours, but not much. And the small end, 3.7 centimeters. Now, I was thinking, I haven't never gotten around to doing it, but of going to one of these garden supply places and buying a couple of bamboos of the appropriate size so we could see what they look like. But if you think about a bamboo sort of that kind of size and hitting somebody with it on the bottom, I think, on all of them, if I got it right, it would be pretty painful, I think. And then the large bamboo, the heavy bamboo, it's 2 inches at the heavy end and an inch and a half at the narrow end. But I don't know. I mean, I don't think... Are there any cases where they mention that somebody receives some number of blows of the bamboo and dies of it? I suspect it was pain as well, but I at least can't remember any cases. It'd be interesting to look through the novels to see whether people got crippled or killed by these beatings. Because I'm... Sometimes. The women got to keep their pants on, though. Might be, or an old man for that matter, could be. But I believe that age as well as gender was a possible grounds for commuting the beatings to monetary payments. And I think it's true for old men as well as old women, but as far as I can tell, all of these commutations are optional. That it looks to me from the cases as though they are all reasons you can ask to have it commuted. And in some of them, it's probably the normal answer is yes, and some of them the normal answer may not be yes. But there certainly are cases where somebody is in a category that can get commutation, and the court specifically says, but this person has acted very badly, and so you should not allow her to commute it. You should actually beat her, actually exile her, whatever that particular one is. Looking. You're welcome to have things in. I noticed one of the fairly uncommon cases where the upper court suggested the lower court might have the facts wrong. And that was one where it was claimed by the adulterous wife and her paramour that the husband tolerated the adultery. It's pretty clear that that's a sort of a sub-theme that runs through a bunch of cases, that in some cases the adultery is being done secretly, in some cases basically the paramour is paying off the husband in some way to let him sleep with the wife, and that affects the legal status of what happens thereafter. In particular, I think that killing the husband when he hasn't tolerated is a more serious offense than killing the husband if he has tolerated. And there are various other cases that come up that are related to that. And this is one where the higher court points out that the lower court has accepted the claim by the wife and paramour that the husband tolerated the adultery, which claim makes their punishment for whatever has happened less than it would otherwise be, that it ought to have investigated to see if there's any evidence. And there's another similar one somewhere where I think the husband kills his wife. I think there are two husbands killing their wives, where each of them, the husband claims that the wife had reviled his parents. And that doing that, I think killing his wife may still be illegal, but it's a substantially less serious crime in that case. And the court points out that the parents at no point came to a court to complain that she was killed or something, I don't know, to complain that the wife had reviled them, which was, I assume, in itself an offense of some sort. And they're concerned, sort of, you think the obvious concern is, after the husband kills the wife, the doting parents, as I think the translation says, will invent the excuse to get him off the more serious punishment. On the other hand, what seems a little odd is that if I read it correctly, they seem to be assuming that if the parents are willing to come into court and testify, then that's all right, and it's only that they haven't done so. So why they believe that they can believe them if they come into court and testify and not if they're just told what they'll testify, I don't know. Maybe they figure that the clever magistrate will be able to cross-examine them and find out if they're making it up or something. I don't know. But that did, as I say, most of the cases, as in most of our appeals court cases, the higher court is just taking the facts as given. And there are almost no cases that I can remember where there's any implication that any of the courts were in doubt about who was guilty. Right? I mean, the closest I can come is this business of the boy being convicted of theft that he hadn't committed. So that's when we're after the fact, they find out they've got the facts wrong. But most of the time, the cases, at least as we're seeing them, read as though everybody knows who did what. Maybe because we're wise, learned, you know, higher beings that with our Confucian education, we're perceptive types. So everybody knows who did what, and the only question is the penalty. Now, if you go back to the earlier set of cases I mentioned, that's not the case, because what's going on there in many of them is it is evidence of how clever the magistrate is, that he figures out what really happened when there's a factual dispute about it. Various sorts of... Somewhere I've got notes on that, and I'm not sure I've got them with me at the moment, but there are a bunch of moderately interesting cases. That, if somebody wants to borrow that book, I can lend it to you. It's a much smaller book than this one, more entertaining, I think. Did people, anybody notice the business of when a killer has to pay funeral money for his victim? Sort of odd. The basic rule seems to be that if the killer is executed actually or theoretically, if the killer's final sentence is strangulation or decapitation, whether or not it's after the assizes and whether or not it finally happens, he does not owe funeral money. I guess on the theory that his life is paid, his debt or something. If he ought to have been condemned to a capital punishment, but for some legal reason isn't, and there are various special reasons why you're condemned to a capital punishment, then your accessory dies in prison, that means a life for a life has been paid, so we will lower it to 3 years penal servitude or whatever the next punishment is. But in any case where the sentence involves capital, but he not only is let off after the assizes, but the sentence is converted for one of these special reasons, now he owes funeral money. But in cases where the original sentence isn't capital, now he doesn't owe funeral money, except if there's some special statute that names this as a case where it does. So it's quite a complicated, I'm not sure it makes any sense, set of rules about when he owes such payments. One thing I did notice, one of the things that you ought to try to do in any of these systems where there are money fines is to see if you can figure out some way of estimating how big they are. Because, you know, if somebody says, why in that society you can kill somebody and get off of the money fine, there's a big difference in our terms whether that money fine is $100 or $100,000. You know, if it's a sum that's going to sort of bankrupt the average criminal, then it's a pretty serious punishment even if it doesn't result in his being locked up or hanged. Whereas if it's a token amount, it isn't. I'm just looking for... Here we are. Yeah, this is one which on my book is on page 342 to 343. And it's actually an interesting case for a different reason, just a minute. It's case 166.3. Some of you have it. And what's going on here is the difference between what we would think of as accidental killing and deliberate killing. And the accidental killing is still seen as illegal, so that I suppose it's something like our wrongful death suit. And what's the difference between accidental killing and deliberate killing? Oh, there's really no difference. It's the same penalty. One very, very small difference, and that is the penalty can be redeemed by a monetary payment if it's an accidental killing. So you get sentenced to, you know, whatever it is, strangling after the assizes. But by the way, if you'll pay us, in this particular sum, 12 ounces of silver, now you can go home again. And we also are sort of intriguing the way in which at one formal level they're not distinguishing, and yet another level there's this huge difference. But what I wondered was how much 12 ounces of silver was. And there is a mention somewhere else that the wage for a worker on a government construction project was 0.855 ounces, so about an ounce a day. So we're talking about somewhere around 2 weeks' pay for a laborer. As the commutation for something which otherwise would have been either theoretically capital year strangulation after the assizes, or maybe 3 years exile, or 3 years forced labor. I mean, I have to go through details, I don't think I have, but it's pretty clear, I think, that these money payments are not much more than token payments, if you compare the size of the money payment to the size of the thing that you're commuting into that money payment. And that I thought was sort of interesting and worth noting. But in any of these systems, I mean, I had this problem when I was doing my Icelandic stuff, because you've got all sorts of punishments in money, and so I tried to get a couple of different measures by which you can compare it. How much does the cow cost? How much money does a person seem to earn per year? And the problem is that for the Icelandic, we don't really have records from the 10th century, but we have various bits and pieces in the sagas and bits and pieces of the law from which you might be able to make a deduction. Actually, that one, it was sort of an interesting case, because I still think I was ingenious, although I'm not sure I was right, because in saga period Iceland, one of the forms of money was wool cloth, called vaðmál. And we know what length of vaðmál corresponds to an ounce of silver. And I happen to know, through my medieval interests, somebody who had spun and woven cloth using the same technology that was used in saga period Iceland, a drop spindle and a warp-weighted loom. So I asked her about how much of her time it would take to make an ell of vaðmál. Well, that gives you at least some very rough idea of wages, because if you can make an ell of vaðmál in an hour, then you would expect that the wage of somebody who spun and wove can't be more than an ell per hour. You don't know how much the wool that you're spinning is going to cost you, but at least it gives you some vague idea of wages. And so I used that to try to make a rough estimate of wages, and then to try to convert it into what was the wergeld for killing somebody. And my memory was that it's quite a large sum in our terms. At least if you try to convert it equivalent length of wages, you're talking about like a $100,000 fine. I don't remember anymore what the exact numbers were, but it was that kind of scale. But it's an interesting sort of project, if you like solving puzzles, to try to get at least very, very rough estimates. So I have another course, which I'm not teaching this year, called Analytic Methods for Lawyers, and I've decided next time I teach it, I'm going to add a section in what are referred to as back-of-the-envelope calculations. So you have some factual question, and it would take a huge amount of research to get an exact answer to it. But quite often, with an hour browsing the web and a little arithmetic, you can get a sort of an answer within a factor of 10, sort of about how big it is. I was just thinking about that because I was doing this yesterday for the question of life expectancy in the U.S. compared to other countries. Because U.S. life expectancy is on the low end among rich industrialized countries, it's way above the world average, but it's below the figure for most of the Western European countries. And I've seen various explanations of why, such as the U.S. has a higher murder rate, the U.S. has a higher traffic accident rate, and other things. And so what I was trying to do in each case was to see if you get a very, very rough estimate of how large an effect on life expectancy each of these things could have, to see whether it was really a plausible explanation. And that kind of project is interesting, but especially if you're doing historical stuff where you can't look up the exact numbers, they don't exist, you can try to get to from the information you have to at least get an order of magnitude to say, you know, is an ounce of silver a year's wage or a day's wage kind of thing, and that's useful information. Let's see. Other points. Again, there are a number of cases which I'm not sure what you call them, but sort of misdiagnosis cases, or the shopkeeper who gives the wrong drug and somebody dies, that kind of thing. And those, again, you have nominally very high penalties, but they're routinely being commuted into much lower penalties. All right, well, if you don't have other questions, I've got somewhere here a list of what seems to be more interesting general questions about that legal system. I can figure out where in my pile of pieces of paper they are, that I thought I would sort of run through at least briefly. And I would start with one which actually we were discussing a few minutes ago, which is to what degree was the law code public information, to what degree secret. You may remember that there's this very, very early quote from sometime BC from somebody who's saying you don't want he's complaining about someone else who's engraved his law code on bronze vessels or something, and he's saying, you don't want people to know what the law is because then they'll figure out ways around it. You want, you know, just to teach virtue and then punish people who aren't virtuous. And I don't think there's any evidence here that actual copies of the law code were forbidden or secret. On the other hand, we do know that they are discouraging various mechanisms for giving legal advice, and given a complicated law code, that may be sufficient. And, of course, some things were criminal that weren't in the code. So in that sense, they don't seem to be aiming at a system in which people can technically just know the law. Another fairly general question, which sort of goes to the theory of the law versus the practice, is to what degree the punishment for an offense is really determined by the law code and to what degree it's determined by the court. And the theory is by the law, but we've seen quite a lot of flexibility in it. They get to decide or not to decide whether aged minors, only sons, women get special treatment in various cases. And the redemption, which is pretty close to a pardoning as far as I can tell, seems to be something where they get to decide whether it is. Their criteria for what you deserve aren't the same as ours, so that when you have a case where there are a number of cases where somebody kills someone under circumstances we would see as very excusable. A man has just killed his father in a fight, and he kills the guy who did it. Or somebody is trying to prevent a rape and unintentionally kills the rapist instead of just stopping him. And those end up with quite serious punishments, and I don't think I saw any discussion in those cases of shouldn't we let him commute it for 12 ounces of silver and go home again. On the other hand, there seems a pretty strong pattern that where we think it's purely accidental, then we let them commute it. Also, of course, the whole business of the assizes gives you levels of discretion, because it means that you get to that someone at some level gets to decide whether if you're after the assizes, whether capital punishment is really capital or not. There are a fair number of cases where the court seems to be ignoring the plain language of it in order to get its results. I'll be getting a little bit to the question, let's see if I can find it, of being a lawyer. This is the one which warns you that if you get in the time machine and go back to Imperial China, you do not want to tell them you're a lawyer, because a lawyer, that's a criminal offense. If you look at cases where somebody is being condemned for something, you've got a statute, the statute specifically says X, he didn't do X, but we'll condemn him for it anyway. I've got a number of specific cases, I don't think it's worth going into them. But let me go to being a lawyer, because that struck me as one of the interesting ones from several ways. One of them, which I've got here, is page 246 in my book, but as someone pointed out, my book may not be the same as the one in the library, which might be a different edition, but this is case 44-1, 1827, prohibition against unauthorized assumption of rural headman's position. And what's happened is that somebody has prepared public notices saying that he's going to set up an office to help people with taxation questions and help settle their disputes. But let's see how we describe it. The governor of Honan has reported a case in which a government military student, Wang Ting-Chu, now dismissed, prepared public notices announcing plans for establishing an office for himself, wherein he hoped to fish for profit by handling taxation matters for people and settling their litigations. He is accordingly now sentenced to 100 blows of the heavy bamboo and 2 years of penal servitude. By analogy to the statute which provides 100 blows in transportation, etc., for anyone who falsely terms himself a power Li had, thereby creating trouble and annoying the people. And the person who revised the text of his document, made copies and distributed, is an accessory and receives a punishment 1 degree less. So So what's going on, that there is a rule against pretending to be officially the head man of a group of households. This person is not pretending to be the head man of a group of households. He's offering to do for people, presumably for pay, some of the things that such a head man might do. We're going to punish him anyway. And another one, case 2035, on my book is page 415. It's a similar case because what do you have here? You have the governor of Anhui has reported a case in which Sui Chuan, an offender from another province, drafted 5 litigation documents for other persons. All of these documents were of an ordinary nature, and there is no evidence that he conspired with government clerks, tricked ignorant country folk, or practiced intimidation or fraud, which are all from the substatute on litigation tricksters. He should therefore receive a 1 degree lesser penalty, namely a maximum penal servitude, than the military exile prescribed for habitual litigation tricksters. Although the offender is past the age of 70, since he is a litigation specialist who brings harm to rural communities, he may not be allowed the privilege of monetary redemption for his offer. So, it sounds as though all he is doing is giving legal help, and that is treated as a very serious crime. But now let me get the real one, and this is the one that should warn you. This is an imperial edict, right? You better listen to imperial edicts. The censor Chu Hung is extremely correct in what he says in his memorial about the need to check abuses of unbridled litigation and so extinguish vicious habits. The multiplication of lawsuits among the people brings much harm to rural communities, and the machinations of the litigation tricksters are what produce all the inconsequential verbiage going helter-skelter into these accusations. These rascally fellows entrap people for the sake of profit. They fabricate empty words and heap up false charges. At their bidding, plaintiffs are induced to bring up stupid nonsense in their accusations, whose empty falsity, when exposed at the trial, brings blame upon the plaintiffs themselves, while the litigation tricksters stand to one side. But you will notice that in the actual case, there's not a shred of evidence that any of those bad things happened, right? There's no evidence that it was an empty case. Perfectly legal documents and so forth. So he gets a slightly lower penalty. The victims of these false accusations, once they have been dragged in, remain entrapped and their livelihood is gone. Even should they have the luck to be completely exonerated as a result of the trial, their families will by then have become ruined. No one knows how many lives have thus been damaged or brought to an end at the same time that the tricksters look on from the side and chirp their satisfaction. All these devilish goings-on certainly deserve our bitter detestation. In all government offices in Chile where cases are heard, let it now be ordered that whenever magistrates encounter a false trumped-up accusation, they must investigate to find out who has instigated the accusation, who has guided it, who has planned it, who has publicized it. As soon as all this has been determined, the person responsible must be immediately arrested, severely punished, and not allowed to escape. In addition, the local officials, whenever accepting any legal petition, should always find out first whether the petitioner himself actually composed and wrote it. Either they may compare the document with the petitioner's own handwriting, or they may take a section of it and ask him to expound its meaning. If the petitioner is unable to expound the section, so how many of your clients do you think, after you have written up the appropriate legal document for them to sue somebody, could expound the legal meaning of each section of the documents that you've written up? Any guesses? They must press him for the name of the litigation specialist who prepared the petition and by no means allow the petitioner to claim that it was written for him by some itinerant fortune teller or medicine peddler. As soon as the litigation specialist has been arrested and brought to account, all the circumstances of how he planned and perpetrated the false accusation. Notice, just a minute, that the first half of the previous paragraph was about encountering a false trumped-up accusation. The second half was whenever accepting any legal petition. So they're very easily sliding between things that are bad and things we'll just assume to be bad whether or not they are. Heavy punishment should always go to him, whereas the person tricked by him into presenting the accusation may be shown leniency. let the investigation thus be probing and painstaking, and then these rascally fellows will go into hiding. The multitude of lawsuits will diminish daily, and decent, respectable people will gain security. So it's perfectly clear that what China needs is tort reform. Right? I mean, isn't it, in a sense, in a much more extreme and one-sided fashion, the same argument that one hears made nowadays about, you know, the terrible effects of tort suits for unreasonable grounds and deep pockets and harassment and, you know, all the extortion and so forth. Which may be true, of course, but we don't have an emperor who is in a position to lay down the law on this matter and get it done. A case which perhaps makes all of this a little more plausible, because the case which perhaps maybe does fit it, is the one which is under case 8-1, 1803, page 218 on my book, which is offenses committed by officials before they assume official status. And that's somebody who does various bad things, including this is someone who is an insider in that he has gotten the degree of promoted man. But he then should have been a district magistrate, but then his mother died, and so he had to return to his native place for mourning. And he went to buy candles at a shop and demanded a reduced price. When the shopkeeper refused, Li decided to take revenge. He put $4 in counterfeit money into a letter and asked the shopkeeper to take it to a friend. Before it was delivered, he asked to have the letter back in order to add a few words, and on opening it in the presence of the shopkeeper, accused the latter of having substituted counterfeit money for real. To avoid a lawsuit, the shopkeeper paid Li $4 silver. And then later he does various other wicked things, and the implication, at least on some of this. Another time, a neighbor lost a hand and thought it might have run into Li's house. While he was asking Li's maid to look for it, Li arrived on the scene, accused the neighbor of making love to the maid, and forced him to pay $10 in settlement. So there's at least some suggestion that the legal insider here, and this is one that's going to be a magistrate, so he's sort of on the official side, though not yet in power, can exploit his special knowledge of the legal system to threaten other people and extort money from them, which may be part of what's going on. Another question is, to what extent do you have defenses? To what extent do things like self-defense do it? But I think actually I've probably gone far enough on this, because I'd like to talk a little bit. I've got a bunch of notes, but when you talk for days more about the Chinese legal system, let me instead switch down on my notes to the Tibetan stuff, because I thought that was really quite interesting as well, and get your comments on Tibet. All right. So how would you describe the traditional Tibetan form of government, of rule? Yeah?
I liked it. I thought it was pretty comprehensive. So you want me to...
I was thinking not the legal system, that's also, you know, it's good paper, but how do they choose their rulers? Is it a democracy?
Now or then?
Then. It's a theocracy is one of the things it is, yeah. How do they choose the ruler?
I don't know
that part. Well, oh, they chose the ruler, 700 years ago, and he's been ruling it ever since.
Yeah.
Right? They believe in reincarnation. That's right. The Dalai Lama is the person who became the ruler. I don't remember the exact date, but something like 1300 or 1400.
And
from time to time, he changes bodies. And this results in a lot of forgetfulness. And, you know, when you find that whatever a three-year-old who it turns out was born, I think it's something like, you know, born the same time the Dalai Lama died. I don't know exactly how they do it. But that's the Dalai Lama. And now it's true that when he's only 3 years old, well, he's in a three-year-old body, excuse me, that you can't expect a three-year-old body to maintain all of the knowledge and wisdom of centuries of rule, so you've got to have a regent who rules on behalf of him until he becomes an adult, but then when he's an adult, he's the ruler. All right, yeah?
I thought it was interesting reading that paper right after the Chinese paper.
Yes.
It did seem like in China that, you know, harmony was for the sake of maintaining the family
order. That even if the parent was abusive or acting badly, they would still refer to his decision. But in the Tibetan system, it was that you avoid conflict because it accumulates bad karma.
Right.
And it seems that was actually more rational than the system was.
Yes, yeah. But part of what is weird about it, I mean, is that this presumably is that you really believe that the Dalai Lama is whatever he was, 500 years or something old, however long he's been going. I mean, he's much older than that, though, because I think that the original Dalai Lama is an incarnation of a bodhisattva, sort of a Buddhist demigod. So in that sense, I suppose many thousands of years old. But that's probably true. Or
the whole practice of polyandry.
I would say perhaps less anti-feminist than they were, but yes. Yeah. Tibet is the only society I know about where polyandry was fairly common. That basically, I think if you look across time and space, that monogamy is the normal mating pattern for humans. That even in societies where polygamy is legal, that the bulk of the population are in monogamous marriages, for one thing. There aren't enough women for everybody to have two or three or four wives. There's an interesting book written in the 19th century by an Englishman who lived in Egypt and apparently spoke the language and knew the people pretty well and was pretty clearly associating with sort of ordinary middle-class people, not with the aristocrats. And his comment, I think, was that not one family in 100 had more than one, the husband had more than one wife. But polygamy is still pretty common in the sense there have been lots of societies where some men had multiple wives. In China, for example, is obviously a polygamous society. Islamic society is polygamous and so forth. Whereas polyandry is quite uncommon. And presumably one reason is that people want to know who their children are. And women don't have a problem because the baby comes out of them. But men do have a problem, and therefore one solution to that is for a woman to have, potentially for a man to have exclusive sexual access to a woman, at least for some period of time. But the other thing is that wombs are a scarce resource, sperm isn't. So you can easily enough, you can maintain the same population in a society where only half the men get reproduces in one where all of them do, but you can't do it if only half the women get to reproduce. That's right. Yes, and of course, for those of us who find Darwin a useful guide to understanding the world, your nephew is half as closely related to as your own child. So having children who might be yours and might be your brother's is not as bad as having children who might be yours or might be a stranger's, because you'd like. Insofar as we can think of the Darwinian argument as a like, it's really a metaphor, you would like to take care of your nephews as well as your kids. Yeah. I'm trying to remember. Which of those? Do you remember? That's interesting. You don't remember where that was? Be interesting. Yeah, the one explanation I've seen is that you get polyandry where the critical resource for producing children is not women's wombs but food. So if you imagine a society where that in lots of pre-modern societies, women of childbearing ages have to be bearing children almost nonstop, given high mortality rates and especially infant mortality rates. So in that, a society is going to be in trouble if you have a system which many of the women don't bear children. But if you think about a society which is very resource poor, where if the women produced all the children they could, half of them would starve to death, now it begins to make more sense to say, well, two husbands can grow enough grain to feed the children one wife will produce, and we're therefore willing to organize it that way. That is an interesting feature of Tibet. But it's interesting in lots of, it's a weird, interesting society in lots of ways, I think. And I should say one thing where the paper, I think, is a little bit one-sided, and that's the question on the relationship between China and Tibet. Because if you sort of watch arguments on this, the Chinese claim is that for a long, long time, Tibet was really under Chinese authority, but it was sort of a semi-independent, you know, locally controlled province of China, as it were. Whereas the Tibetan version of it is no, until the Chinese invaded us a few decades back, we were completely independent. I suspect the truth is somewhere between those two, that relationships aren't always very sharply defined. Yo?
I was struck by the desire for people to avoid seeking the legal remedies.
Yes.
Because in some ways the punishment or the legal remedy would be just as bad as the wrong that was done, because it would be an action at the same time. But there was the one, what happens when you punish a thief? Well, now his hands are empty. He's not a thief anymore because the punisher has done just something just as bad. And it's like an interesting way of turning everything on its head.
Yeah. Yeah, there's certainly, there seems that in the case of China, there is a practical reason to avoid being involved in legal disputes. And in the case of Tibet, it looks as though that exists, but that's reinforced by a religious reason, that having a dispute is itself evidence that somehow you've got something wrong. It's certainly a weird system. Is it fairly clear what's going on with inheritance, in particular inheritance of land? What are they trying to do with their not very sharply defined pattern of who inherits the land? Because in an odd way, it's a little bit like the Dalai Lama situation, not with reincarnation, but they're trying to make sure there is always a male head of the family who is the person in charge of things, and therefore when the existing one dies, they're trying to find that relative who can best fill his place. At least that's my reading of it, that the eldest son, but if the eldest son can't do it for some reason, the next son, if that can't do it, I think there are some circumstances in which the father's brother gets to take over, and I don't remember what all of the different details are, but it looks as though, especially in a system where I suppose if they've got no heir, the land may forfeit to whoever they're holding it from, because,
If they had only North daughters, they would choose the daughter that was most likely and most willing.
Yes, I think that's right.
Then they would have to hurt children.
Yes, right.
That's
right. But presumably, if I understand it correctly, her husband would be the one in charge of things for his lifetime, I think. That is, I think they are normally aiming at a male head of household, though I may be mistaken in that. One of the things that we'll see when we get to Athenian law is a somewhat similar pattern where basically if you have a man who dies without any sons or grandsons but with a daughter, so the daughter is an heiress, the daughter is then supposed to marry the closest male relative not within the incest prohibitions who will have her. And that again looks like it's somehow a mechanism to maintain the household structure, as it were. Yep.
It seemed like in the reading that how I took it was also working together with how brothers would marry the wife, and that you wouldn't keep on splitting the land.
That's right.
The brothers were having, there wasn't enough land, you'd been splitting the land.
Right. And so then the child who is nominally the child of the elder brother, if I've got it right, so they don't know which brother it's really a child of, can inherit it, and they aren't dividing it up among the elder sons of both brothers. Yeah. One of the other weird things about it is that lawsuits are never over. Right? That is, unlike ours, you have a dispute between two people or two families, and the court reaches a result and says, are you willing to sign this? We can't end it unless both sides agree to it, and both sides agree to it, and 5 years later, one of the sides decides, well, we shouldn't have agreed to it. We're going to tear that up and start over again. So that it's a system in which all legal disputes are open forever. Which seems very bizarre to us. Yeah?
I think maybe that was kind of balanced out with the whole karma thing. Because if, you would reopen it, you intensively...
Might well be, yeah. That's right. But it may also be a system where, in effect, many people have potential threats against each other. And you normally, if we reopen that lawsuit, I'll get him to reopen that lawsuit against you. And I don't know. I was sort of thinking a little bit, because in our system, we don't have that for cases that have been settled, but we do sort of have things like patent infringement issues, where I can have a bunch of patents, and you have a bunch of patents, and I do something that you think infringes your patents, but there's the threat that if you try to sue me for infringement, I will find one of my patents that I can claim you're infringing and countersuing. I think we've actually been seeing that happening fairly recently with Apple and I forget who else, but one of the other big firms where one of them sues the other and the other one suddenly discovers an infringement and countersues. So that's a sense in which you can have legal cases that are sort of sitting around unresolved that you could bring up at any point, whether or not you're actually going to do so. One of the features that's a little bit like the Chinese one is that the equivalent of the district magistrate seems to move around. They describe them as holding office for about 3 years, but something that we didn't at least get described, I don't think, in the Chinese, though it may be happening, is that there are local people who are part of the same system who don't move around. So you've sort of got, maybe that's the equivalent of the headman who was mentioned earlier in the Chinese, but you've got I forget what they called it, but I think two local advisors to the magistrate who are from the district, stay there, and presumably keep passing it on. One thing that some of this stuff in both the Chinese and the Tibetan was reminding me of, have any of you seen the TV series Yes Minister? It's a British, quite popular British series in which one of the characters is a British minister, somebody with secretary or something or other kind of thing, and then his private secretary. And it's clear the secretary is really running things. So that the minister will hear some outrageous story about some misdeeds and say, we've got to do something about it. And by the time the private party, yes, minister, yes, we've got to do something about it. By the time it's over, he's sort of turned it entirely around so they're not really doing anything at it at all on various excuses. And the implication, which I think is probably true of the British system, is that you have a system where the secretary is the long-term civil servant who's been in that position for 20 years and knows where all the bodies are buried, and his nominal boss is a member of parliament who, for a year or two, when his party's in power, is the minister of X, Y, and Z, and theoretically he makes all the decisions, but at least the implication of the program, whether correct, I don't know, is that really the decisions are really being made by the professional. Yeah. But yes, that they do have, as in some of the other Wehrgeld systems, that is systems of payments for killing, a fixed set of monetary amounts depending on the status of the person who's killed. Now, I'm not sure if that's all that happens, though, because, again, I'd have to look at it more carefully, because it's clear you can get whipped a good deal in the process of the case, and I'm not sure whether in some of these cases there's an additional criminal penalty in addition to the fine or not, which I don't remember if the paper makes it clear whether that is or isn't the case. Yeah?
Something I thought was kind of interesting was as part of the alternative dispute resolution,
yep,
they would roll dice in,
yes,
cases, or draw lots in,
yes,
cases where it was just unclear.
Yes. Yeah. Well, but versions like that aren't all that uncommon. They also, I think, swear oaths, which is something we'll get back to when we look at Jewish law. And there are really two ways of interpreting a bunch of these things. One of them is that they really believe in the religion, and therefore they say, God will be on the side of the person who's just. So the dice will come up the right way. And I think they've got a story there, I think it was an oath, not that. I think it's in there where she mentions the story of a woman who swears to something that isn't true, and her nose starts to bleed and she dies in a few days or something. So if you believe in that, but the other possibility is that there may be cases where even if you knew it was random, you would say, well, look, we've got to settle this dispute. Neither of us has the evidence sufficient to be sure of winning the case. We'd rather have it over, flip a coin. Right? And that's not an unreasonable way. And I think it's very hard for an outsider to tell how much of which element is going on in these cases, how much it's just a... Now, the oath can't be that, because we know perfectly... If we don't believe in it, then we know you'll be willing to swear a false oath. If we don't believe it, I think you don't believe it. I think the oaths are pretty clearly a case. And we also, in one of the things we're not covering this year, which were the Plains Indians, you also get the use of swearing oaths as a way of settling legal disputes. And again, you have at least the supposed belief that if you swear falsely, the relevant divinity will punish you accordingly. Anything else? All right. For next time, what you're reading, I did check that it is on reserve, and what you're reading for next time is a chapter on essentially contract law in Imperial China, very near the end of the period, we can read that and discuss it, and that's interesting in part because it's describing a system which nominally doesn't have much in the way of contract law, and yet where private action is giving you the equivalent of contract law pretty effectively. All right, any other questions? Fine. See you all Thursday. Enjoy your reading. And get those papers. That is, decide what you're doing papers on. I don't expect papers to be in for a while yet, but you ought to, if I know now, to have a pretty clear idea.